If you need help getting Social Security disability benefits, then this podcast is for you. Give me 15 minutes and I'll pull back the curtain on disability and reveal the secrets to winning I've learned over the past 25 plus years. Hi, I'm Jonathan Ginsberg, and I'm a practicing Social Security disability lawyer. I want to help deserving claimants just like you win the benefits you deserve and not one penny less. Now, if you already know you need help today, go to ssdanswers.com for a free and confidential evaluation of your case. It takes just 2 minutes. That's ssdanswers.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Now, let's start the show. Welcome to part two of my conversation with Social Security Disability Appellate Attorney Brian Konosky. Last month, Brian and I spoke about hearing decisions and the type of errors that often lead to a remand by the Appeals Council or the federal court, and a second hearing for you. In this episode, we talk about vocational witness testimony and the opportunity for appeal that arises when a judge omits limitations from the hypothetical questions he poses to the vocational witness, or when a vocational witness identifies jobs that don't exist anymore or that are performed substantially differently than what was described in a 40-year-old job description, you read that right, 40 years old, from the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. An important point to note, Brian looks at unfavorable decisions day in and day out, and the errors he sees in these hearing decisions tend to occur over and over. Social Security assumes that most claimants and hearing attorneys will not review unfavorable decisions with such a trained eye. This is why he strongly encourages, and I do as well, both claimants and claimants' lawyers to have an appeals specialist available to review every unfavorable decision. And that's why I asked Brian to appear on this podcast. Now, on to today's episode.
Now, the way decisions are written, the judges will send it to a writer, if I'm not mistaken, who was not there. And again, you know, for those who don't know, you appear before a judge, the judge hears testimony, I assume makes notes, and then sends it off to a writer. And I actually had a former employee of mine who went to work for Social Security as a writer, and he kind of painted this picture of a floors full of cubicles with its staff attorneys in there busily reviewing records and doing that. And I suspect that some of the mistakes are coming from the fact that the writer wasn't there and is having to kind of, you know, interpret what the judge is saying. Is that something is that your sense as well, that some of the mistakes are made because the writers are just, they don't know, or they're sloppy, or whatever else happens?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically what you have at the administrative level, you have the ALJ, judge makes the decision. Judge is super busy, right? They have to sit in hearings all day long. And then, so they don't have the time to sit there and then write a decision. So what happens is they give it to their decision writer. Decision writer, who was not present, gets some notes from the judge. And that may indicate what the judge thinks the outcome should be, ballpark. The decision writer then has to sit down and try to fit the facts into what that opinion is, that judge's anticipated opinion is. And they may not have all the facts. They may not have everything or all the reasons that the judge really wanted to make that decision. And so the decision writer will draft the opinion, but things are missing. And then it goes back to the judge for signature, and the judge signs off on it or approves it. And then it gets filed, and that's the decision. So yes, I think the bulk of the errors first come from the decision writer, but then the errors are kind of approved by the ALJ, who has to sign off on it. And that's where the problems come in. There's a disconnect between the decision writer and the judge.
Yeah, I often thought that was, I realize the judges don't have time to actually draft decisions, but it just strikes me very odd that a person who was not there, is listening to a tape maybe, but is trying to write a decision. But again, that's just the way they do it. Do you see, I assume that you see the same mistakes by the same judges over and over, or certain judges just inherently more sloppy than others in your experience?
If you need help getting Social Security disability benefits, then this podcast is for you. Give me 15 minutes and I'll pull back the curtain on disability and reveal the secrets to winning I've learned over the past 25 plus years. Hi, I'm Jonathan Ginsberg, and I'm a practicing Social Security disability lawyer. I want to help deserving claimants just like you win the benefits you deserve and not one penny less. Now, if you already know you need help today, go to ssdanswers.com for a free and confidential evaluation of your case. It takes just 2 minutes. That's ssdanswers.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Now, let's start the show.
I find that the same judges will oftentimes make the same errors repeatedly, over and over. I also find that aside from an individual judge that makes the same errors, if you're in a specific state or jurisdiction, I find that the judges, almost all of them in the same jurisdiction, will actually make the same errors, almost like they've been trained together, they think together, they've kind of got this way that they approach things together. And if one of them makes a mistake, they're kind of all making the same mistake. So I actually find in some jurisdictions, I will accept repeatedly on the same general issues. If I know a case is coming out of Kentucky, I know that there's always going to be a certain number of, let's say, supportability and consistency problems. If it's coming out of Minnesota, I know that they're not properly evaluating superficial social limitations. I know that there's certain jurisdictions that have particular problems over and above others. Individual judges, but individual jurisdictions as a whole do the same thing over and over again.
Got it. Let's talk about vocational witnesses, because I know that, and by the way, for those, again, who don't know, Brian posts a lot on LinkedIn, video clips and shares a lot of knowledge on LinkedIn about some of the mistakes he sees and some of the decisions that he's dealing with, which is very much appreciated because I've learned a lot from it. I know that you speak a lot on LinkedIn about the vocational witnesses and some of the mistakes that they make. Talk to me about that a little bit. Tell me about the vocational witnesses, some of the things that you see, mistakes that are being made and avenues for appeal based on vocational witness testimony.
So there are errors that come down from vocational experts. A lot of times there's a disconnect between what the judge is finding in terms of the limitations of the judge's finding to what the vocational expert is asked about. So when you have testimony, the vocational expert, the judge always has to ask the vocational expert a hypothetical question. Assume an employee or a claimant of certain limitations, certain age, education, and with these particular types of limitations, whatever they are. That's a hypothetical question. When that hypothetical question is asked, it's incorporating all of the limitations or potential limitations a judge finds or may find in the case. Those limitations are asked to the VE, because then the VE has to give testimony that based on those limitations, what jobs are available in the national economy that the claimant can do. What happens sometimes is that the ALJ will ask questions but omit limitations that the ALJ is finding to exist. So let's say a judge finds a medical opinion to be persuasive. The medical opinion finds that the claimant cannot have more than superficial contact with supervisors and coworkers. And the ALJ asks a question, hypothetical question, of a vocational expert that asks about, are there jobs available for all these reasons? Plus, if the claimant has superficial limitations with coworkers, but can interact appropriately with supervisors. So in one hand, he finds a doctor persuasive that finds superficial contact exists with supervisors. On the other hand, he asks a question to the vocational expert that omits that entirely. The law pretty much holds that your vocational expert questions have to shadow your limitations with precision. It can't be close. It can't be, hey, we almost got it right. And that's because the vocational expert can't tell a judge if there's jobs available unless he knows what all the limitations are. This type of error happens very frequently. The interaction between the VE and the ALJ oftentimes could be, it falls short. It just doesn't comply with the law, and you can get cases remanded that way.
And I know that I've seen some VEs, and again, for those who don't know, the vocational witnesses use a resource called the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, among other things, that is like last updated 40 years ago. I mean, it's just absurd how old this is, but they still use it. And I assume, what Social Security keeps saying is they haven't found anything better, but doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But some vocational witnesses will cite jobs that are just obsolete. I mean, you know, document preparer is one that's gotten a lot of press lately, you know, in the listservs because it refers to microfilm. Well, no, you know, nobody uses microfilm anymore, so that's an obsolete job. So things like that, that, you know, vocational witnesses just make, you know, they have their set number of jobs to answer questions, because realize at a hearing, a judge is going to ask this long hypothetical, and the vocational witness is typically going to have three or four jobs, you know, at his or her disposal to describe. And again, they may not change those for years. And I know in my career, which is, I've done this for about 30 years, you know, one point surveillance system monitor was the classic, you know, entry-level unskilled job. And then somebody realized it's not quite so simple and unskilled, and they moved on to other types of things. But I guess you probably see a good bit of vocational witness testimony citing to obsolete jobs or jobs that are not, there's not really significant numbers of those jobs anymore. Is that the case?
It's a big problem.
Yeah.
It's a really nut sorter.
Mm-hmm.
Who's
nut sorter? Right.
Yeah, that's not a real thing.
I mean, right, exactly. Yeah, I don't think I've ever had a nut sorter, but I've got a lot of document preparers and things like that. So, yeah. And I don't know why they got rid of surveillance system monitor. That for years, that was the go-to, but then that seems to have gone away. You talked about time off task, and this is a question that does pop up in judges' hypotheticals. The person is off task. And one of the things that I always found kind of fascinating is that some vocational witnesses will say that 10% of time off task outside of normal breaks is excessive. Some will say 15%. Is that inherently an appealable issue? Is there any sort of standard about that, or is it just depends on the vocational witness?
Yeah, I've seen that, and it always bothers me, because is there a standard in the industry, or is there not a standard in the industry? You have a group of vocational experts that say you're unemployable if you have to be off task greater than 10% of the workday, and others that say, you know, 15% or greater. It's like there's no standard. It's just, you know, the Wild West of making decisions. But the there's standing alone, I have not been able to raise an issue on that. You're kind of stuck with a vocational expert's testimony because they're the expert. They're using their training, knowledge, and experience, and that's the nature of things. It's the same as if you had doctors testifying, kind of like in a car accident case, the two different doctors with different opinions. You could pick one or not pick one. They might be right, they might be wrong, but they're the expert, and that's kind of where you're at on this with the vocational experts. It's terrible, though. I mean, it's just...
Right. It should be consistent. It really should be consistent, but it's not. And just briefly, I want to ask you about one other thing regarding vocational witness testimony, and that is job numbers. Because, again, the DOT, Dictionary of Occupational Titles, does not really address job numbers. A lot of VEs will talk about something called skill trend. What is that, and what is the significance of that?
Well, the DOT really doesn't talk about, you know, let's say... It doesn't really define full-time or part-time, but Skiltran, they go to Skiltran because Skiltran gives the numbers of the jobs, available job numbers of the jobs in the national economy. So even though the DOT is what controls, which we talked about just a few moments ago, experts will still look to Skiltran to determine how many jobs of a particular type of job exist in the national economy. And then they rely on that, and then they use their training and experience based on the hypothetical to either reduce that number based off of whatever limitations there are, including time off task being one of those. And so let's say the job is, you know, 8,000 in the national economy. An expert may say, well, you know, in my experience, it'd be 20% less if you had, you know, a certain amount of time off task or something. But yeah, they rely on Skiltran for the numbers of jobs.
And Skiltran's a private company, if I'm not mistaken, right? It's not a government agency or anything like that, so.
Don't know where to begin? Get my free Secrets to Getting Approved Survival Kit. Inside the kit, I discuss such things as, how do you know if you have a case? What to do if you're denied? How to avoid common mistakes? And my ever popular, how to avoid trick questions from the judge. Subscribing is free and easy. Just visit ssdanswers.com and look for the survival kit for instant access. Remember, time is eroding your position every day. Don't delay, act now. That's ssdanswers.com for your free survival kit.
All right. Now, you know, this comes up sometimes, and you know, one of the things that I've always found very disturbing about Social Security is that judges within the same hearing office, you may have one judge that approves, again, 20-25% of cases, judge next door approves 60%. So whether you win or lose, it becomes a lottery. First of all, is that an appealable issue at all? Can one argue that the inconsistency amongst judges would be an appealable issue? Is that just the way the chips fall?
It's just the way the chips fall. I think there's attorneys that are taking it under consideration whether there's anything that can be done about it. Mm-hmm. To date, as far as I know, there's not much that can be done about it. My view, it's absolutely horrible. I remember I had an attorney reach out to me once, upset because they got the short end of the stick on the draw here. They had a judge that had a 4% approval.
4%. Yeah. 4%.
How claiming as a judge that you're non-biased, that you're fair and impartial with a 4% approval rate? I mean, the flip side, of course, is that if you had a 96% approval rating, you're also not fair and impartial.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the middle, if you're approving that many, you're not fair and impartial. If you're denying 96%, you're certainly not fair and impartial. But there's a systemic widespread problem, and there are some judges out there that are, don't get me started.
I know. And look, I think, you know, what I expect from a judge is a fair hearing and to be respectful to the claimant who's probably waited 2 years for this hearing date. You know, again, sometimes you have judges that rush through things or just not very nice to the claimant. Again, as long as the judge is fair, I don't really care about that. But yeah, like you said, I mean, a judge who approves 4% or 10%, when the standard, by the way, the average nationally is about 50%, I think, at this point. That just seems inherently unfair. I have noticed that the judges that approve, you know, 80-90%, those seem to be being moved out. They look at those very carefully, but the ones that have the very low approval rates are, don't seem to be moved out quite as quickly. So again, it's just the nature of the beast, I guess, but it does get very, very frustrating because I know, you know, there's a lot of resources out on the internet about approval rates for judges. And so more and more of my clients are looking at that. And they'll, you know, we'll do a pre-hearing call and they'll say, well, I saw this judge only approves 25% of cases. Are you concerned about that? And my response is, you know, we have to put on the best case we can. It is what it is. But, people do know that and they get real frustrated with it. So, but again, like you said, there doesn't seem to be much we can do about that. Let's segues into my next question. I'm in a hearing. I think I've got a client who I believe in. I think has got a good case. The person really is disabled, but you get the sense, you know, at the hearing, the judge is just not buying it. Doesn't like the claimant's being insulting. Is downplaying all the things the claimant is saying. Anything I can do to prepare that record for appeal?
It's really hard. You're between a rock and a hard place in that situation because claiming that the judge is biased based off of things that the judge may say on the record is really hard. Can it be done? Yeah, I've seen it done, but the judge's statements have to be quite egregious and really shocking. So it's really hard. I think the best way to address this is to have, you know, if a claimant needs a good lawyer from the beginning, somebody who's diligent, somebody who knows what they're doing, somebody who's going to work the case up as best as possible. And I always suggest to lawyers, and a lot of lawyers will say, well, I do this anyway, and that's fine. But interestingly, you know, like I said, the reason why you need good lawyers is not everybody, you know, does it, but you really need to get as many, let's say, medical source opinions. And sometimes the claimant has to help with that. You know, claimant has to bring a medical source statement that maybe a lawyer provides to a doctor and get it filled out, because what you want in that situation, you may have a hard judge, a difficult judge, but you want to give a reviewing attorney for potential federal appeal in case there's a loss. Every opportunity to find an issue. And a lot of times, the more medical source statements, the more medical opinions you have from treating doctors or regarding assistive walking devices or opinions regarding, service animals or any number of things, canes, assistive walking devices, anything you can get in the record that's an opinion. Because the judges, like I said earlier, a lot of times judges trip over the evaluation of the medical opinion. So when you create more medical source statements, I mean, you can't always get them from everybody, right? But you get as much as you can. As long as you're getting some for the record, you're giving more opportunities for the ALJ and the brief writer, the decision writer, to make mistakes. You're giving more opportunities for error. The more times you give an opinion over to them to review, the more opportunity they have to mess it up. And it happens a lot. They'll perfectly evaluate one opinion and then they'll butcher the other one entirely. And that gives you a way to stick it back to them on appeal. You know, you get it back, you get it remanded, you get it reversed. You'll improve the odds on the remand at that point. They'll not be so ready to deny you a second time.
Is it your sense that the law, the way the Social Security's policy and so forth is becoming less friendly to claimants? And the reason I ask is, I mean, a few years ago, we had this treating source rule that was eliminated. And I know the listings, when they get reviewed, they typically make the listings more difficult to meet. Is your sense the trend is sort of against claimants in terms of making it more difficult to win, or am I just imagining that?
Imagining things. They made it more difficult. I remember, and again, this is just me speculating. I remember a number of years back, there was an election process, and all the politicians, it was like the buzzwords about Social Security, and Social Security is losing money, and the system is fraught with fraud here. It's like such a nominal amount compared to any other possible system, because you have so many hired experts that are paid by Social Security, and it's evaluated by a judge, and there's no settlement process or anything. You have to go through the whole process. It's nonsense. But because of all of that, they didn't change the age for Social Security retirement. But what they did was, to combat that, in my opinion, they changed the rules. They made it more difficult to win. The judges are not as lenient. They're more strict. They're more difficult. And they tightened it in so that now people who were truly disabled and who deserve the benefits and need the benefits to just even make ends meet are getting denied. And it's really a travesty. It's absolutely horrible, but you are absolutely not wrong. This is what we're fighting against. This is what we're combating. And again, this is why anybody pursuing benefits needs the best attorney that they could find. People like yourself at the administrative level, because without that, you're fighting an uphill battle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, you hear that, you know, I'll see it on my YouTube channel. People post, you know, all these people, it's all this fraud. There really isn't that much fraud. And they make it, I'd say there are many more people who should be on that are not, that get denied, than the people that sneak through. And I think obviously we have Eric Kahn to thank for some of this, you know, the high profile fraud cases and so forth. Let me ask you about just briefly about the treating source rule. And again, for those who don't know, used to be that a doctor who had treated you for, you know, years would be given controlling weight, as opposed to a doctor who saw you one time for Social Security in a consultative evaluation that would be given less weight. They got rid of that, which makes zero sense to me. Have you found that judges are denying cases based on one-time CE report, consultative evaluation reports, or not examining state agency reports, versus are they really ignoring treating doctors? Is that happening, or is it just more of a, you know, much ado about nothing?
No, they are. They're denying cases based off of one-time evaluations or non-treating evaluators, and they're disregarding the treating doctors, which the old rule was much more beneficial. Right. And it made sense. If you have a treating doctor who sees you all the time, and what they write down and tell a court or, you know, a hearing office what the limitations are, you should give some sort of deference to that. The new rules require all doctors to be evaluated the same, which relates to supportability and consistency, which are the primary factors to evaluate. Was their opinion supported by something they did, consistent with the other medical evidence? And they, because of that, it created a lot more room to find that the medical opinions are not consistent with the records, and the judge can use a lot more discretion in finding it's not consistent. And so then they reject the treating source of opinions, and the treating source opinions most often are like, you know, I've treated this client for years, you know, this my patient for years. This person can't work. This person can barely walk. This person's in pain all the time. And they just throw that out, and they rely on a doctor who's never seen this person a day in their life, who sometimes the claimant doesn't even know this doctor, never saw the doctor, doesn't even know who it is. They just wrote up a document and submitted it in the file. It's outrageous, but this is what we're dealing with.
Well, that's a wrap for today's episode. Subscribe to this podcast for regular updates at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you found this podcast useful, then please give me a 5-star review because it helps others see the value of my information. Thank you in advance. For a 100% free and confidential evaluation of your case, visit ssdanswers.com. That's ssdanswers.com. Don't delay. Act now.